Looking for some new art inspired by the national parks? Then be sure to check out our online store, The Gaze Shop.
This season, as we explore the landscapes of Olympic National Park, Mount Rainier National Park, Carlsbad Cavern National Park, and Guadalupe Mountains National Park, we've got some new items and designs coming your way.
Introducing our Olympic National Park and Mount Rainier National Park posters. These 12 by 18 posters make a great addition to any home or office, or a great gift for any lover of the national parks, even if that national parks lover is you.
Whether it's art for your wall or a sticker for your water bottle, you're sure to find something that sparks your love of the outdoors. Visit shop.gazeatthenationalparks.com to bring some of the national parks home with you.
Hello, and welcome to Gaze at the National Parks, the podcast. I'm Dusty.
And I'm Mike, and welcome to our Season 7 Summit. Heart, don't fail me now.
That's right.
Courage,
you almost
don't
did that.
Desert me.
At karaoke.
You harangued me into it.
You chose that song yourself. Mm-hmm. I chose nothing.
We're like, we're going to do karaoke. You're going to do a karaoke. You're here. No one is going to see you ever again. You're going to do this.
I said, yeah, we're at karaoke. Do something. And you were like, well, like the Kristen Wiig character that's like, don't make me sing. Uh-huh. You were like, I mean, I guess I could do Anastasia. And you went and put it up. But then it took too long.
Me.
I didn't force you.
And beer spilled on me.
Our summit episodes are our season wrap party. It's our way of encompassing all of the parks we visited this past season and viewing them through four different lenses that investigate these parks a little deeper.
These summit episodes allow us to look at the parks from the season by examining the visitor experience, the history, the environment and wildlife, and on a much grander scale, the hiking and experiences within the parks. Each episode is sort of like a category of Trivial Pursuit. If you've listened to our show long enough, you know that games and trivia are sort of our jam. The second of our four summits is about history. Oftentimes, the history of a national park is dwarfed by its natural splendor. But the job of the National Park Service is to not only preserve spaces, but also memories, ephemera, and historical facts.
Before we begin this summit episode on history, it is worth noting the term erasure. Erasure, for our purposes, will come into this episode in many ways. Specifically, related to the indigenous people of each of the park spaces we will talk about. Through centuries of erasure, many indigenous tribes who once called these national park spaces home have seen their history and legacy deleted or omitted from the narrative of the national parks. This is why, at the start of every episode, we acknowledge these spaces and the people that once inhabited them and still inhabit them, and why we do our research on these groups of people before we head to a new park space, because everywhere in America is native land. Accept and get used to that.
While we want to continue to highlight indigenous peoples in this episode, along with other historical events that shaped the parks themselves or brought them into being, at the start of this episode, we would like to talk about historical erasure of a different ilk. The erasure of information related to people of color and the LGBTQ+ community, which has been perpetrated through the fledgling months of this new presidential administration.
In order to frame this in context for events that have come prior and to counter arguments that may be brought up to rebuff the harm caused by erasing history, we have to point out the movement of removing Confederate statues and renaming places and spaces that were once named for heroes of the Confederacy. A great deal of this push and sweeping change came during the onset of the COVID pandemic, coinciding with the preponderance of murder of people of color, specifically Black Americans, at the hands of law enforcement. That being said, the seeds of this pushback were long ago planted, as you can hear in our trail mix, Monumental Failure, with a large swath of these monuments to Confederate soldiers and generals being erected during the height of the Civil Rights Movement.
The pushback and removal of Confederate monuments and Confederate-named places was often decried on the right as an erasure of history during this period of time. One could argue that, but the greater argument holds regarding the continued pride and upholding of these ideals of abhorrence for which the Confederacy stood. It would be like the German people keeping monuments to Hitler and the Nazi Party around after the war, a rot that would only seek to reinforce the ideals of hate and allow them to more easily spread anew.
It should also be noted that the great deal of this national conversation was happening during the current presidential administration's first term in office and not under the power umbrella of another party. However, what we see currently is this administration, in its second go-around, actively working to erase history in real time. Specifically, several online events have sought to erase the importance of Harriet Tubman and her role in the Underground Railroad while removing trans individuals from the history of the Stonewall Inn, while also purging information on the contribution of queer people in Boston to the LGBTQ plus movement.
This erasure takes the contributions of these marginalized groups of people to the rich tapestry of American history and casts them away, belittling the struggle and the triumph of overcoming hatred and continuing to build diversity. But in the end, that's the goal, because diversity, equity, and inclusion are not things to be lauded under this current presidential administration. The work of this administration is to continue to promote a cisgendered, white, heteronormative agenda and to actively fight against anything different.
So much so that in May of 2025, Interior Secretary Doug Burgum, who is actively working to alter the Park Service and its mission, has asked all national parks and public lands to post signs that ask visitors to self-report any signage or information that may tell a negative story about the site or its history as part of the executive order called Restoring Truth and Sanity to American History. This order reeks of erasure as it seeks to identify and change anything that, quote, inappropriately disparages Americans past or living, including persons in colonial times, from national parks and monuments.
History is dark and is many times unfortunate, but teaching history and using the national park spaces to do it as America's storyteller helps those visiting to have better context for understanding the spaces and the motivations of the people who make up its history. Giving context about a person or a place who was a negative figure in history is part and parcel of their actions in life and cannot be divorced from reality or whitewashed. Removing monuments or renaming places which celebrated those who worked to uphold a system of human oppression is categorically different and acts as a correction to past harm and wrongdoing on a granular level, as opposed to the erasure which is continuing to be perpetrated.
Yikes.
Yeah. I mean, it's very easy to see what's happening here.
Oh, yeah.
And it's also very easy to look at these two separate events. And I brought up Confederate monuments because it's something that is going to be brought up as a counterargument to what's happening right now.
Of course.
So, but when you look at both of those things, they are completely 100% different from one another.
Yeah.
Yes. However, in the minds of cisgendered white Christian nationalism, people of color and LGBTQ plus people are a threat. So that's, you know what I mean? That's sort of
right.
Their counter argument to that.
Well, right. And it's back to like responsibility, accountability. This administration loves to play victim right and left every single time. Well, why are you upset with us about what happened years ago? That's negative. Why are you being negative? And it's like, honey, it's way bigger than that. And you're making these things because you don't want to even acknowledge any role that your ancestors, our ancestors, played in genocide, in colonization, and, you know, murder, and all of the things that we just outlined. And covering up all of that nonsense that just further buries the truth. Yeah, that's what it is. Mm-hmm. Bearing the truth. When we don't deal with the hatred, it just takes another shape,
mm-hmm.
right? Like this is like a morphed form of it
yeah.
that we're seeing now that existed in the 1990s,
mm-hmm.
before that in the 1980s, before that in the 1970s. I mean, bigotry and hatred and white people not wanting to take accountability or responsibility has not all white people, like, hashtag not all white people, whatever, but people who align themselves with this level of hatred.
Right.
It's like, you know, that is what becomes of it.
Yeah.
And here we are, and we have to deal with the consequences. But I do always feel better when you read people to filth.
Mm-hmm.
So for a little palate cleanse, let's take a look at the parks of this season through the lens of history. Though it may not be the kindest, learning history always gives us better context for understanding our surroundings, time, and space. While this won't be the entire history of the park space, it will give us a broad overview, which gives us better context for the space in question.
Our first park from the season is Olympic National Park. We would like to acknowledge that while visiting the land also known as Olympic National Park, that we are on the traditional unstolen lands of the Lower Elwha, Tklalom, Jamestown Tklalom, Port Gamble Tklalom, Skokomish, Quinault, Ho, Kulit, and Makah people.
The Olympic Peninsula is home to a vast majority of indigenous people, of which many tribes still retain residency. We know that for at least 13,800 years, people inhabited the peninsula as spear points inside unearthed mastodon skeletons found near the boundaries of the park can confirm this information through carbon dating. We love science.
We do love science.
These prehistoric people likely used the land bridge to cross to the Americas, eventually making their way to what is now coastal Washington.
At the time of their arrival, the level of the oceans was likely 120 meters lower than it is today, presenting quite a different shoreline than we currently have. Through glacier melt over time, the shoreline shifted to what it is now. That being said, the indigenous people of the land continued to utilize the shore and rivers and forest of Olympic Peninsula for all they needed.
The Makah, Ho, Quinault, and Kulit people, along with others, would come to establish a community on the peninsula using what was available. By way of wood, they fashioned tools, shelter, and watercrafts, which provided for travel, movement, and fishing. The Makah were particularly adept at woodwork, specifically by way of watercraft, as they developed permanent fishing villages around Cape Flattery and on Tatoosh Island. These people also opened trade with indigenous relatives across the strait of what is now the Strait of Juan de Fuca on Vancouver Island.
One oral history from the Makah that centers around a village buried in the Ozette Triangle region of the peninsula is that of the Great Slide. After a storm in the Ozette region passed through in the 1970s, a hiker discovered a great deal of wood and debris that had been unearthed. After contacting the Makah tribe, who in turn contacted the University of Washington, this oral history was proven to be actual history as a multitude of wood-based artifacts, an entire village, was rediscovered.
Directly to the south of the Makah, the Kulit inhabited the land from Cape Alva to the Ho River. Prodigious woodworkers in their own right, the Kulit did not hunt whale as the Makah did. Along with hunting seal, they gathered shellfish and hunted more terrestrial animals. Though the Makah and the Kulit were enemies and even raided each other for slaves, the tribes also engaged in trade and intermarrying of nobles, as well as potlatch ceremonies. A potlatch marked an important event in the life of a tribal member, in which lavish gifts were distributed to the guests. While it was a way of showing off wealth and status, it was also a time to share stories and histories and engage and forming alliances.
The Ho were people of the river, and they used the river for its bountiful resources and shelter it provided. The watershed of the river provided for the cycle of life from seasonal campgrounds for their people, as well as their burial grounds for their dead. While the Quinault, whose land and current reservation was further south, were known for their superior canoe construction, of which they could hold upwards of 50 people, their trade networks were extensive and allowed for contact with other tribes in the region.
Eventually, European influence became great within the region. While Juan de Fuca's name is on the strait that separates the land also called America and the land also called Canada, it is uncertain that he ever saw the body of water. Other Spaniards eventually made their way here, as well as English and Americans. Most came to take advantage of the sea otter and fur trade, as well as to hunt for seals and whales. And while the Spanish would set up a settlement in Naya Bay, eventually other foreign powers would outnumber them and they would abandon the area.
Through Captain James Cook's 1770s expeditions to the region, it was clear that the fur trade in the region would be incredibly valuable. With so much measured interest between the British, Americans, and Russian traders and trappers, the entirety of the sea otter population was essentially wiped out by 1910, with few remnant colonies remaining. Eventually, a treaty was signed to ban the hunting of sea otters and seals.
While this territory was a hotly debated one, especially in regards to trapping and trade, eventually treaties were signed which enabled the Americans and Brits to coexist in the Pacific Northwest. Through many kerfuffles over several decades, eventually in 1846, the Treaty of Oregon would be signed, which would allow for American control in the region, with the Brits just across the way in British Columbia.
As Americans pushed ever westward, Native peoples eventually signed treaties which would give them reservations on the peninsula, the Treaty of Naya Bay and the Treaty of Olympia. The treaties also set up rights for these people for hunting, fishing, and gathering of resources on Olympic Peninsula and their adjacent waters in perpetuity. In the 1970s, these treaties would again come into the spotlight as these tribes sought to have greater access to their resources and have their treaty rights upheld in court, which they were eventually.
As the time marched ever onward, the Olympic Peninsula and its people dealt with Japanese submarine attacks on vessels during World War II and fleets of Russian fishing during the Cold War. The park and its indigenous people have continued to flourish and exercise their rights in their spaces of the Pacific Northwest.
Let's turn our attention to another park of the Pacific Northwest, Mount Rainier National Park. We would like to acknowledge that while visiting the land also known as Mount Rainier National Park, that we are on the traditional and stolen lands of the Cowlitz, Muckleshoot, Nisqually, Puyallup, Squaxin Island, Yakima, and Coast Salish people.
Before we talk about the indigenous people of Mount Rainier National Park, we have to mention the volcano itself, which has undergone a variety of changes in a 1 to 2 million year period. Most notably, the lava flows that helped to build the current mountain and subsequent surrounding ranges to their current heights. Volcanism in this corner of the world is due to the subduction of the plate of Juan de Fuca off the coast of North America.
While it has been at least 1,000 years since an eruption on Mount Rainier, it was over 2,000 years ago since the last lava flow. That being said, Rainier has had some reports from the 1900s that report dark clouds at the summit, but no ash or related volcanic material has been collected or studied that would lead scientists to believe that an eruption, albeit a small one, had occurred. That being said, the recent activity at Mount St. Helens is an indicator that volcanism is alive and well in the region, even if dormant at the moment.
As time marched ever onward, we have an understanding, due to archaeological record, that the relationship of the tribes with the mountain shifted. While 15 to 10,000 years ago, the mountain was largely iced over in a permanent snowpack, people lived in the valleys that surrounded the mountain.
Eventually, about 9,000 to 8,500 years ago, the mountain's mid-slope ranges began to thaw, and as early as 4,000 years ago, people began to utilize these areas seasonally.
The tribes associated with the park all have their own name for the iconic peak, including Tahoma and Tacoma, among others. These indigenous people utilize Mount Rainier in warmer months, working to hunt and gather in the subalpine regions of the mountain. From food to resources, these indigenous people acted and continue to act as stewards for this space.
The landscape of the West rapidly changed as explorers and settlers moved into the area. The push and pull of the land and what white Americans believed to be theirs eventually ended with several treaties, including the Treaty of Medicine Creek, the Treaty of Pine Elliott, and the Treaty of Yakima, which ceded lands of the indigenous people of Mount Rainier to the U.S. government, with the provision that these people could still hunt and gather on the land, though, like most government contracts with non-white individuals, the interpretations of these treaties varied greatly.
While, unlike the indigenous people of Olympic National Park, the tribes that utilized Mount Rainier did so only seasonally. So while reservation systems were set up for those tribes within the bounds of the Olympic Peninsula, these tribes, though using the land less frequently, still had reverence for it and held a great importance to their history therein.
Like so much of the new westward territory that was explored, the park soon became a magnet for visitors and intrepid mountaineers, excited to summit the peak. Eventually, spaces were developed to house visitors of the park as interests both recreationally and in resources grew. In an effort to better protect the park, areas that surrounded the park were named as forest reserves. Eventually, these reserves grew in size as the lust for timber in regions surrounding the park also grew.
The park was formed in earnest in 1899, and by 1911, the road to Paradise and through Longmire was finished, which made accessing the mountain even easier. Despite the formation of the park and its popularity, which was explosive, especially in the Seattle-Tacoma area, mining and timber companies still worked to access the park until 1908, when legislation was passed that severely curtailed these enterprises.
The development of the National Park Service bolstered the protections of the park and also garnered better education for the visitors throughout interpretive programming led by rangers. The park, in an effort to better patrol the boundaries and environs contained within, began a trail system that surrounded the mountain. The network of smaller trails was fully completed in 1915 and dubbed the Wonderland Trail.
As time marched on, the park became a standard in many ways. The National Park Service rustic architecture, which is that of natural stone and wood and found in many national park sites, was first developed here. The park was also a jumping-off point for Mission 66, which sought to expand and upgrade visitor centers and facilities and simultaneously work to alleviate the crowds from increased day use. This period of time also saw expansion and development of the Ohana Pakosh section of the park, as well as the finishing of the Stevens Canyon Road, which joined the east and west sides of the park.
Rainier continues to be a popular park which is steeped in history and beauty. The attendance of the park has only continued to grow, from day-use visitors to those intrepid folks who want to summit the peak. Efforts to continue to ensure the best visitor experience have been underway over the last several decades, as well as a continued mission to preserve and protect the natural splendor for generations to come.
Hey y'all, it's Dusty and Mike with exciting news.
That's right, it's our episode finder. It's all about making finding our episodes even easier.
Want to find more episodes about hikes in Shenandoah? With over 10 episodes across two separate seasons, it would have involved a lot of scrolling and searching.
Now, with our episode finder, you can find all those episodes with a few easy clicks. That way, finding an episode on Yosemite from season 1 is just as easy as finding an episode on Zion, Yellowstone, and Haleakala, all in separate seasons.
With over 275 episodes in 35 different national parks, our episode finder will add ease when finding out more about hikes in these spaces.
But it's not just about hikes by national park. We've categorized our entire library so you can find hikes by state, hikes by terrain, and hikes by difficulty.
And all of our Trail Mix episodes are there too, so you can easily find our science-based episodes, interviews, and more.
Planning a trip to Colorado and want to hear more about our adventures there? Want to grunt it out on some really tricky trails or learn more about glaciers, grasslands, and mountains?
Just click the link in our show notes or on our Instagram bio, and it pops right up. You can also head directly to our website and look for the episode finder at the top of the navigation bar.
Conquer one hike in one national park, one park at a time, with just a few clicks with our episode finder. Happy trails!
Traveling southeast from the Pacific Northwest lands us in Guadalupe Mountains National Park in Texas. We would like to acknowledge that while visiting the land also known as Guadalupe Mountains National Park, that we were on the traditional and stolen land of the Mescalero Apache and the Lipan Apache. The history of Guadalupe Mountains National Park is more sparse and desolate, as this park and its desert environs were not the most hospitable to the people of the region. That being said, for at least 10,000 years, people did inhabit or visit the space known as Guadalupe Mountains National Park. Archaeological evidence shows their history, though scattered through a variety of objects, including points, arrows or spears, pottery, and other forms of art or craft.
In the mid-1500s, with the expansion of the Spanish Empire and the New World, brought horses to the region, which became an important lifeblood to the Apaches, who called this land home. They utilized the horse to continue to roam freely throughout the areas of the Southwest, including within the park.
Despite the advent of the horse for the Mescalero, as the centuries rolled ever onward and manifest destiny pushed settlers further west, scouts were sent to survey routes for a new transcontinental railroad, which could bring miners and ranchers and homesteaders ever westward. While these routes never passed by way of the Guadalupe Mountains, a stagecoach route for the Butterfield Overland Mail did. The Pinery, a stagecoach station, was constructed within the bounds of what is now the park. This can still be seen near the Pine Springs Visitor Center.
Both the stage line and the settlers of the area demanded protections from the Apaches in the region. A number of cavalry troops, including the Buffalo Soldiers, reported and eventually pushed the Apaches from the region. Despite the Butterfield Overland Mail route moving to a further southern route in the following year, the destruction of Apache camps by the Buffalo Soldiers showed the Apaches that their time in this space had come to an end.
Eventually, more homesteaders and ranchers moved into the area in the late 1800s. Frijole Ranch, a residence for several families, was completed in 1876. The ranch became a hub of life for the region in the first half of the 20th century. Other ranchers and homesteaders and scientists helped to develop the land and eventually, through donation of their properties, helped to create the environs of the park. Together with the Frijole Ranch, the land of another rancher, J.C. Hunter Jr., and that of Wallace Pratt, the park eventually took shape and was formally opened as such in September of 1972.
And just about a half hour down the road, we arrive at our final park, Carlsbad Caverns National Park. We would like to acknowledge that while visiting the land also known as Carlsbad Caverns National Park, that we are on the traditional and stolen land of the Mescalero Apache and the Lipan Apache.
Like Mount Rainier, it is impossible to talk about Carlsbad Caverns without mentioning its geological history. About 250 million years ago, the caverns were located on the coast of a giant inland sea. The sea, which eventually dried up, left behind an exposed 750 feet thick limestone formation, which makes up most of the park.
In the more recent history, let's say 20 million years ago, the crust of the earth uplifted here by 10,000 feet, which exposed the reef and created the Guadalupe Mountains. About 12 million years ago, the oil-rich Permian Basin, which is nearby, caused hydrogen sulfide-rich water to mix with groundwater and created sulfuric acid within the underground. This caused the limestone reef, which is most of the park, to dissolve from above and not below. The roof of this newly formed cave collapsed, creating the natural entrance, and allowed air to circulate through the cave. Over millions of years, the rich tapestry of the cave itself, its speleothems, formed.
Similar to Guadalupe Mountains National Park, Carlsbad Caverns National Park has indigenous history, which is tied to the Apaches. However, other groups inhabited this area, including the Carlsbad Basket Makers, as evident by the pictograms and Mescalero pits found at the mouth of the cave. While the cave was likely not deeply explored due to lack of light, it is likely that the mouth of the cave was used for shelter and other purposes, Mescalero pits.
While the indigenous influence and presence is undeniable, less information on these specific groups is available, like it is for other park spaces. However, like many other cave-based parks, the titillation of exploration and understanding the importance of preservation of such an impressive natural wonder holds true.
In 1898, the cave was, quote-unquote, discovered. Nothing is really discovered. Anyway, in earnest by a 16-year-old young man named Jim White. After seeing what he believed to be smoke from a fire or volcanic eruption on the horizon, he followed it until he discovered that it was thousands of bats birthing forth from the mouth of a gigantic cave.
Upon further investigation, he traveled down toward the big room. Eventually, years later, he would relay the story to Abijah Long, who filed a claim to mine the guano from the cave. He turned around and made Jim head of operations.
Jim allowed tourists into the cave. Two such intrepid guests brought a photographer with them, Ray V. Davis, who captured 24 images of the cave, some of which were later published in the New York Times. This publicity ignited excitement throughout the country and the world over. Catching the attention of Washington, D.C., a surveyor was sent to the cave to determine whether the cave should be protected or not. This fast-tracked the cave to become a national monument.
When the cave was eventually taken over by the MPS in 1926, Jim became the chief ranger of the cave, giving tours which were lit by electric lights. While Jim never claimed to be the discoverer of the cave, that title was thrust upon him, whether willingly or not. The cave continues to be a draw for people the world over, and its preservation in its current state is due to the fact that it was recognized by so many as an important geological feature within the country.
The sources for this summit episode include the MPS park websites for Olympic, Mount Rainier, Guadalupe Mountains, and Carlsbad Caverns National Park, the Olympic Peninsula Community Museum, the Olympic Coast National Marine Sanctuary, the United States Geological Survey, westernnationalparks.org, and NewMexicoMagazine.org.
And now let's end this episode with a queen and a game. Thaddeus and gentlethems, please welcome to the stage, Chapel Ruin.
Okay, Chapel Ruin.
Chapel Ruin.
Okay, we recently did Chapel Groan.
We did.
Chapel Ruin is different.
She is.
She is. Chapel Ruin.
Well I mean,
we have a lot of opportunity here.
It also sounds like what it is. It's like, oh, a ruin of a chapel.
I mean, it does. But
she doesn't have to be a Christian queen.
No. I feel like she is a klutz queen. She's a physical comedy pratfall.
Breaks things.
Like, ruins everything. Like, that's the joke, right?
Yeah.
Like, Chapel Ruin is, the comedy is in, like, everything is falling apart around her at all times. Yeah. She's in on the joke and has caused it, right? So it's like, oh my God, I've backed up and the curtain fall. It's like she is the play that goes wrong as a drag show. I really like that.
I'm just like imagining all of the things that you could do.
Stunts.
Like stunts and just like, oh, here's like a pyramid of champagne glasses and like,
oh yeah,
you know,
it's
the whole
like Lucille
show,
Ball.
But the whole show is like, oh my God, is she going to actually knock it over? And there's so many times where it's close and then like something ridiculous happens at the end that causes
something
the...
else happens. Yes. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
That's what I mean. It's like everything's going to go wrong, but in like the most delightful way.
Mm-hmm. What does she sing?
I feel like she...
Don't say yakety yak.
I do love that song. I need it to be sampled in something. Please, somebody use it again. I do love that song. Mm-hmm. I still put it on to clean. And maybe I'm the only one, but you know what? I know I'm not. There are those out there.
Mm-hmm. Yakety yak stands.
Yeah. Yes. That's right.
Yeah.
Here's my thing is like, I don't know that the songs are necessarily related to the fact that like everything's being ruined or
everything
like falls apart or anything like that. Because I think like the joke is that she comes out to genuinely, sincerely do a number or something. Mm-hmm. And then all these things happen.
Yeah.
So like every single time she's out there, it's an attempt. It's a sincere attempt. And then it's just like disaster. Womp. Right. Exactly. Yeah. But it's like planned disaster.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like that's why it's funny. I don't think that Chapel Ruin necessarily has like a, is like a queen that's going to like perform in like a night of other queens at a bar. Like imagine like a theater space in Provincetown. And she's got like a whole hour because like all that stuff has got to be set up prior.
Sure.
You know what I mean?
I do think she could sing My Kink is Karma though, because that's all about.
Oh, yeah. I think she does Chapel Roan.
Right. But I think that would be her like, highlighted song.
I like that.
Yeah.
I like that. I'm into that.
I don't know that she has any merch though. I don't know what it would be.
No, I think you could like pick up pieces of broken whatever
Stagecraft.
On your way out.
Yeah.
Right. Right. But I mean, imagine her coming out and she wants to do, like, she does a dress reveal, but what it does is it, you know, it knocks over the microphone, which hits the curtain, and the curtains fall, and then you can see into the dressing room, and then she's trying to fix the curtains, and as she does that, like, the door flies open, and wind comes in and knocks everything down, and then, like, she's swinging from the chandelier to try and, like, you could change the music as everything happens, you know what I
mean? But I think she's singing as she's doing this.
Oh, I think so, too, and I think part of the gag could be that then something happens to the sound booth, so like the music keeps changing, so she has to keep singing something different every time.
Yeah, it is like a I Love Lucy episode.
It's a she could be my favorite queen we've ever come up with. Chapel Ruin. God, I love this. Maybe we should just do this.
We
could interchangeably be Chapel Ruin.
We could be.
Because you would need the tech. You'd need the technical person to help bring everything to life.
We can do it all.
We could.
Mm-hmm. So, Thaddeus and Gentlethems, please welcome to the stage.
Chapel Ruin.
I also do think she could sing Anything You Can Do, I Can Do Better. Like, that feels like an appropriate song there. But Chapel Ruin aside, it's time to end our episode with a game. So last year, during our Histories episode, we played a game called Threads. And I really love this game, and I wanted to bring it back around. And since all of our Summit episodes are like a game of Trivial Pursuit, this is the History category of Trivial Pursuit, or the Brown Wedge.
No, it's yellow.
The Yellow Wedge. What's, is Brown sports?
No, no. So in Trivial Pursuit...
Blue is science
and
nature.
Pink is entertainment.
Uh-huh.
Blue is history.
Blue is history.
Green.
You said yellow.
No, I'm sorry. Blue is geography.
Okay.
Yellow is history.
Uh-huh.
Green is science and nature.
Mm-hmm.
Orange is sports and leisure.
Okay. Why did I think there was a brown? Was there at one point and they changed the color?
There is a brown and it's arts and literature.
There it is.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Great. All right. So the yellow wedge. All right. So here's how this game is going to work. I am going to offer you the year that a national park was formed, And then I'm going to list three events that happened in that very same year, and you're going to need to name the event. And this is a game we've played before, so you should be A-OK fine here.
Great. Great. I'm so ready.
For 100. The year is 1899, and Mount Rainier is established as a national park. This pain relief company, no, not Tylenol or Advil, patented aspirin. That's clue one. This enterprising businessman and automobile assembly line creator left the Edison Illuminating Company, that's clue two, and Spain cedes this semi-autonomous island nation to the United States, making it a U.S. territory, that's clue three. So you need to answer all of those three.
Okay.
So who patented aspirin, not Tylenol or Advil? Who was the enterprising automobile assembly line creator who left Edison line?
Henry Ford.
That's correct. And what island nation did Spain cede to the United States, making it a semi-autonomous space?
In what year?
1899. And it's made it a U.S. territory, which it still is.
Puerto Rico.
That's correct. So what company, not Tylenol or Advil, patented aspirin?
Bayer.
That's right. You got it.
Okay. So Bayer.
Mm-hmm. Henry Ford.
Henry Ford and Puerto Rico.
Yep. Great. Okay,
great. And these are all going to come back around later.
Nope. They don't. It's just you answering historical facts about the same something that happened in the same year that the park was
formed. Oh, that's right.
Formed.
That's right. Thank you.
For 200, the year is 1909 and the Mount Olympus National Monument is established. This bridge that connects Lower Manhattan and Brooklyn opens. W.E. B. Du Bois, Ida B. Wells, and Mary Church Terrell formed this organization, which still fights for the rights of people of color. And the first race was held at this track, which would later become a mainstay of NASCAR.
Okay, so the first one is the Brooklyn Bridge. It's the Manhattan Bridge.
That's right.
Okay, great. It was one of the two. And then the second one is the NAACP.
That's correct.
And then the third one is the Daytona 500?
It's the Indianapolis.
Oh, the Indy 500.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, great.
Great. For 300, the year is 1930 and Carlsbad Caverns is established as a national park. This soccer organization hosts its first World Cup. This planet slash not planet was discovered, and the 30th U.S. Census asks people if they owned this piece of technology.
What year was this again?
1930.
Okay, so for the first one, what is the it starts with an F.
Mm-hmm.
Is it FIFA?
Mm-hmm, that's right.
Look at me knowing that. Mm-hmm. I can't believe that. And then two, it was, what's the clue again?
This planet, not planet, was discovered.
Oh, Pluto. Mm-hmm. And then the third one, is it television? Is it radio?
Yeah.
Okay, there radio. We go, 1930.
Okay. Great. For 400, the year is 1938, and Olympic National Park is established as a national park. This European country is one of the first annexed in the Second World War, just as it was in the First. This campaign surrounding a small bit of currency was launched to fight polio in the U.S. And this first patent for this synthetic material was granted, and hosiery, among other things, was never the same.
Okay, so the first one is a annexed country. Is it Poland?
Mm-mm.
No. What is that?
Austria.
Austria. Okay. And then what's the second one again?
This campaign surrounding a small bit of currency was launched to fight polio in the U.S.
Oh, was it something with a penny or a dollar? No. What is that?
What's the March of Dimes?
Oh, the March of Dimes. Oh, okay. Great. And then the third one again?
The first patent for this synthetic material was granted, and hosiery, among other things, was never the same.
Okay. It's either spandex or rayon.
It's like one of the first synthetics. Sorry, this was a 400.
Elastic?
What's nylon?
Oh, nylon. Okay. Great.
All right. And for 500... The year is 1972, and Guadalupe Mountains is established as a national park. This tricky politician was reelected to the presidency, but would ultimately be taken down by scandal. Great Britain dissolved this territory's government, trying to instill peace there. And the Magnavox Odyssey was released as the first one of these.
Okay. So the first one is Nixon.
Correct.
The second one, remind me.
Great Britain dissolved this territory's government trying to instill peace there.
In 1972.
Long-standing conflict. Still ongoing. Incredibly close to Great Britain.
Ireland?
What part of Ireland?
Northern Ireland.
There you go.
Okay. But listen, the Brits,
they fucked over a lot of people.
Yeah. And then the third one.
The Magnavox Odyssey was released as the first one of these.
Is it a cell phone?
Mm-mm.
Or a telephone?
Mm-mm.
I remember Magnavox. Is it...
Magnavox dealt with your TV.
Is it a portable TV?
No. Would you like me to give it to you?
No.
It's something that is enjoyable for many teens that currently and will continue to be enjoyable.
Oh, is it a video game?
It's a video game console.
Video game console. Got it.
Yep. There you go.
There we go.
And that's histories. Looking for more episodes like the one you just heard? Then be sure to check out our episode finder for episodes by park, state, hiking difficulty, and terrain, as well as all of our Trail Mix episodes in one helpful place. Click the link in the show notes of this episode, our Instagram bio, or visit our website to make your listening experience even easier.
This has been Gaze at the National Parks, the podcast, and we're here to remind you to hike early and hike often, and that adventure is always out there.
Gaze at the National Parks was created, produced, edited, and hosted by us,
Dustin Ballard
and Michael Ryan.
To see images from this episode, follow our Instagram at Gaze at the National Parks. To contact us, email us at gazeatthenationalparks@gmail.com. And to find out more about the parks visited on this show, visit our website, gazeatthenationalparks.com. That's Gaze, G-A-Z-E.
All original artwork featured on Instagram and on our website is by me, Michael Ryan.
All original music was written and performed by Dave Seaman and Mariella Klinger, with Sean Sklios on guitar. Our music producer is Skylar Fortgang.
We would also like to acknowledge that while recording this episode, that we were on the traditional and stolen lands of the Lenape people, also known as New Jersey.